My name is Evie Wilde, and my new book is called The Echoes.
There's something about the format of a ghost story that offers readers an unfiltered view of a character. Evie Wilde's new novel, The Echoes, is certainly a ghost story, but one that uses the device of a ghost to learn intimate details about the lives of Hannah and Max, a young couple living in London. Hannah hails from rural Australia, and she's haunted, in a sense, by her family's past trauma. I recently spoke with Evie Wilde about the Indigenous, Aboriginal, and Torres Strait Islander history in Australia and how generational trauma is passed down. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Evie Wilde. There are so many things to unpack in this book, so perhaps we should start with a brief description. What can our listeners expect if they pick up a copy of The Echoes?
Well, it started life as a ghost story, but really I think it's a sort of love story. It is, I hope, quite funny. A funny ghost story was my kind of remit, but there's a lot of darkness there as well. So it's kind of about lots of different angles on one person, and one of those angles is what a ghost sees.
So maybe we should talk about Hannah and Max, because their relationship is complicated and not altogether blissful. They keep some significant secrets from each other, don't they?
They do. I think what I wanted to do with Hannah and Max was reflect how little we know each other in relationships, and how often, you know, that gets the blame for their breakdown, when actually a good relationship is a mess, I think. I think, you know, people are so messy. We don't know ourselves, let alone the person we're living with. And so I think I really wanted to not sugarcoat their romantic life. I wanted it to reflect, you know, I started writing it during lockdown, so I was locked in with my husband. And so I really wanted to reflect that in their relationship, and in the bickering and the getting on each other's nerves, and then still finding a baseline of love there and companionship.
As the story unfolds, we learn more about Hannah's past and the trauma that has impacted her and her sister Rachel. And some of this is direct trauma they experienced, and some of it is generational trauma that impacted their parents and grandparents. Hannah has some healthy and unhealthy coping mechanisms. Can you talk a bit about the effects of generational trauma?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that happened while I was writing this book, and I was trying to, you know, when I write a character, I write them in layers. So I don't know who they are from the get-go, and I learn about them as I write them. And I discovered that my Australian grandmother was in an orphanage for quite a long period of her childhood. And it was because her mother couldn't afford to look after her. And suddenly, having not known that at all, that suddenly made sense of who my mother is and who I am, and who I am to my son and how my son behaves. And I just found that so fascinating, that there are these inherited traumas that we might not know anything about, but they're in like the micro movements of our parents and our grandparents. And they trickle down, just like when you read something and it kind of leaves a ghost within you, a ghost of feeling. I feel like it's that kind of that real kernel of trauma that kind of gets passed down, whether you know about it or not.
Some of the characters buried their secrets in a hole in the backyard. Some of them baked them into bad cakes that came out bitter and hard and unlovely. But Hannah's family lives adjacent to, or, you know, Uncle Tone lives inside, a quote-unquote schoolhouse where Indigenous, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander children were, quote-unquote, re-educated, but really were stripped of their cultural identity. How did this aspect of Australian history influence The Echoes?
Well, it's a story that I grew up with, and as a white Australian, which I'm half Australian, you can't tell from my accent. My mother's Australian, and so to me, that part of history was this story, and it was that when she was a child, she was aware of these other children being taken from their families, and the way that it was spoken about within her family was the understanding of the day, which was like, well, it's better for them in the long run, which we know is completely fabricated. But it was really sort of forced down everyone's throats. And I think I grew up with that kind of in my head that just like there is a way that you can be born into this world which sees you taken away from your parents and everything you know, and then sees you just adrift because you're not allowed to speak your own language. Your name is changed. Their family could never find them again because they were just another Aboriginal child adrift in a place that wasn't their own family. And I think the very real trickle down, or it's more than a trickle, the booms of trauma that echo over those generations are extraordinary. And so I think that as a white Australian, there is, of course, an awful lot of guilt. There's a huge amount of inarticulacy with it. It's very difficult to talk about because, you don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to re-traumatize anyone. And you don't want to either not go far enough or erase the history from the land, which is so sort of steeped in blood from the moment that we colonized it. I think that it's always been something that I have struggled with putting into words because they're not my words to play with. So what I did was I wrote about that struggle rather than directly the experience of the First Nations peoples. And I still, I think there's still an argument that maybe I shouldn't even have done that. It's such a sensitive, massive subject. I am very inarticulate about it, and I sort of want to own that inarticulacy.
There were a couple of phrases I noted while reading, and one which showed up twice was, I think sometimes silence is better than the wrong person speaking. I think that's what you're talking about here.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really wanted to acknowledge that. I think by the end of the book, I guess I come down strongly on one side in that I have spoken about it, but I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm still open to that being the wrong choice.
Another phrase I noted that was repeated often was, as much as anything else.
Yeah, that was these little tics that we all have in our, I say all the time. There we go. And I think that they're so, when you start to get irritated with somebody that you're living with, they sort of rear up and they become so important and massive. And it's something that my husband says quite a lot and drives me nuts. So, and I think when you unpack the language of it, it's really fascinating. It's a bit like that phrase, it is what it is. It means nothing, but it's so damning, as much as anything else could be the weighing up of the whole of your life, or it could be like, we've only got dried herbs. It's
And I think I recall Max's mother saying it, so he got it from somewhere.
the trauma.
So I noticed a few, beings that inhabited the book, both in the past and present, and I wonder if you can touch on them. Let's start with spiders. I imagine the spider as kind of a ghost, one that is rarely noticed and observed, similar to, to Max in a way. Am I onto something here, or is this far off?
I think I often use, especially when I'm writing about Australia, I often use the sort of fauna as to stand in for something. I think the wolf spiders in Australia or the huntsmen are so, my family live on a farm out there, so the spiders are inside the house very much, and they're just part of, you tuck in your mosquito net, you look at the spider on the wall and you know that it's not going to run across your face in the middle of the night. And there's like an understanding. And I think, those spiders have always been there. They are thousands of generations passed from the original spiders, and they get inside your home regardless of what bug spray you use, what kind of netting you put in the corner of your room. And I think that's what I like about the spiders in particular, that unless you are constantly, vigilantly clearing your house, like 100% of the time, they're going to get in. And I think that's really lovely. It's like the earth coming into your home.
What about sharks and moths? Any significance there?
Sharks and moths. Well, moths, moving back to England, I feel like every home I've lived in has been full of moths. And it feels like a very British thing to, open a cupboard and there's just like, psh. I think, again, they get into everything. And that's really interesting to me. And the method of trapping them using like pheromone strips is kind of this weird, beautiful thing where you peel the backing off one of those strips and suddenly you notice that the air is alive with these little, golden moths, and they're all coming for you. And I've always found them really interesting. Sharks are like a almost like a verbal tic with me. They are, I think it comes from being half Australian, but living for most of my life in the UK. As a child, I would confuse the size of them. I thought every shark was the size of a double-decker bus. I thought that they were coming for you. It's quite a British way to think about sharks, that they're going to get you in the swimming pool or in the bath. I wrote a graphic novel actually with my friend Joe Sumner all about that, called Everything Is Teeth, and all about what sharks mean to me as a creative person. And I think what I love about them is they are, on the one hand, we think of them as like one of the last truly monstrous things in the world that we don't understand, that are older than trees, all of that mythos around them. But essentially, they're just doing their job. They're not there trying to kill us all. They're just doing what they do, in the same way that I need to eat chicken Kiev occasionally. They need to eat a swimmer.
Want to talk about point of view or perspective. I usually say one when I mean the other because I get them confused. But the chapters alternate, between perspectives, and all of the characters are in third person except for Hannah. Hers is in first person. Can you talk about this choice?
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of playfulness that goes into writing a novel. And, once I've got the story down, sometimes there are voices that come in just from a slightly different angle. And I kind of wanted her, essentially all of these voices are in some way looking at Hannah from different angles, even if, the ones where she's not born yet and they don't meet her, they're adding fuel to the fire that ends up being Hannah. And I wanted her own view on it in a way. So I think you get a very different effect using first person and third person. And I just really wanted both. I felt that I want to know how she thinks, and I want to know what I think about her. So that felt really important. And also, when you've got first person, they can lie so much more to themselves and to the reader. So that's always quite good fun.
I found myself looking up words I was unfamiliar with. Cherry ripe, minstrels, lamingtons, Tim Tams. They were all sweet treats. Well, a couple of words I looked up were brand names for antiseptic. But are these treats favorites of yours?
Cherry ripe is amazing. Lamingtons, my grandmother used to make a lot of. She was a My family live on a sugarcane farm, and she was a baker. So, yeah, there's a lot of sweet tooth in my family, which I try and avoid, but it's not really worked out.
A better baker than Carrie.
Yeah, well, actually, she made an awful lot of dense cakes because she was allergic to eggs. So she had to substitute stuff, and quite often they were quite weird.
You did introduce me to something new. Well, you introduced me to several new things, but one in particular is the green parrot in London. I had no idea.
Oh yeah. We have flocks and flocks of them. In fact, you might be able to hear them screaming in the garden at the minute. We have about 20 on a bird feeder at once. And I think they're just pets that were let loose, and they have bred. And there are lots of bad things, obviously, about introducing a foreign animal to land, but I do like them. They're really obnoxious and funny, and yeah.
They've done their own colonization, That was Evie Wild, author of the book The Echoes, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.